This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
With the 23rd pick in the 2018 NBA Draft, the Indiana Pacers select Aaron Holiday from UCLA.
When Aaron Holiday's name was called at last year's NBA draft, basketball fans were already familiar with his family. His brother Drew is a guard for the New Orleans Pelicans and a member of the NBA's all-defensive team. His other brother Justin is a six-year NBA veteran. Their parents, Toya and Sean, both played college basketball at Arizona State. But those fans may not have known about Toya and Sean's other child, Lauren.
People should know that she was a really good basketball player.
That's Aaron.
She was probably the best out of all four of us. But most people wouldn't know that because they didn't see her play.
Only a Game's Matthew Stock has the story.
Lauren Holiday says it's no surprise. As kids, she and her three brothers played a lot of basketball.
We always had a basketball hoop growing up from what I can remember. And we had the basketball hoop right in front of our garage. And we would just play like two on two.
Yes, there was a basketball hoop.
That's Toya Holiday, Lauren, Aaron, Justin, and Drew's mom.
And they never had it at 10 feet. They always had it lower, like at about 8 feet, so that they could slam or whatever, you know, do all these funky tricks.
Obviously, Justin and Drew were, being the oldest, they were the team captains. And then Aaron and I fell into whoever's team that day.
Lauren says sometimes she and Aaron would switch teams in the middle of their games. They didn't really keep score. They just played.
They would just be out there all the time. Like, I'd be in the bed. I'd go to bed at about 9:30 at night, and they're outside playing ball.
And things got competitive.
They would always end up just upset because everyone wanted to win. Like, I'm taking it to you, and you have to be the best. A lot of times, I'm sort of in the kitchen looking out the window because I have to cook dinner, or I'm folding up clothes and things like that, and then they're running in the house. Oh, my gosh. You know, he kicked the ball down the street, or he threw the ball over the fence, and, you know, things like that. But it always would turn into fights. And I'm like, okay, you guys, if you can't play together, we're going to bring you in the house, and I'm going to open the Bible, and you're going to write one of these scriptures on strife.
Lauren and Aaron were the youngest, just 3 years apart. So they'd almost always end up guarding each other.
Oh, she was fierce. She would, and, you know, at times, I'd be like, okay, you can't hit her because she's a girl. And if you guys really hit her, no, they're like, she's hitting us. I'm like, okay.
For me, it was kind of like outdoing Aaron and proving, like, to my older brothers, like, yeah, I could play. Like, I know that this is, like, it's three boys and me, but I can do it too.
Did playing with your brothers boost your confidence as a basketball player, or did it kind of have the opposite effect?
No, it definitely boosted it. Just when they would, like, if I dunked and they were like, oh, snap, like, that just made me feel so good. I think it made me love basketball even more because it was something that I can do with them.
My husband and I talk about this all the time. The reason Aaron has such a motor and he's so persistent and just strong is because of Lauren. Lauren was the one that would just take it to him all the time and just like, no, you have to be better.
She always went hard at me for sure.
That's Aaron again.
She plays hard pretty much every possession that we've ever played, so that's probably why she was the toughest.
We always talk about if we're going to have a team, because there were six of us, like Sean and I always talked about, okay, who would you pick on your team and how come? Well, Lauren would be the one. I'm like, okay, Lauren's going to be on my team because I know that she would just solve it. If there's a problem, she'll just figure it out.
On the court, Lauren was a lockdown defender. And that figure it out, I got that mentality. Lauren was like that off the court, too.
I think about this. She was sort of the mommy of everyone. So if we traveled, we were going somewhere, Lauren would be the one that will remember to bring snacks. And she just wouldn't bring snacks for herself. She'd have snacks for everybody else. She was always like that. And she always wanted to be Aaron's mom.
I call him my son. Everybody who's my friends, who are close to me, know that that's my son.
I'm like, no, I'm the mother.
He's saved in my phone as my son. When I yell in the other room, I'm like, son, come here. Yeah.
And she would always like, oh, Aaron, let me do this for you. She'd lay her clothes out at night. And she's like, Aaron, you're going to lay your clothes, your uniforms out, because we got to have them out. So when we get up in the morning, we just put them on. So she just sort of helped with everything. And of course, I didn't mind. I'm like, good job, girl. Way to help mama out.
When Lauren got to high school, her mom became her basketball coach. Toya says her daughter was talented enough to play all five positions. She says if she ever forgot one of the team's plays, Lauren would correct her. Lauren started getting recruited to play in college, and one school stuck out, UCLA. It was close to home. Her brother Drew had gone there. She liked the coach. In Lauren's mind, it was a done deal.
And then UCLA hired a new coach. And we were talking like, hey, okay, are you still going to try? You need to chit-chat with the coach. And she's like, oh, no, that's where I'm going. I'm like, well, I think you probably should introduce yourself to the coach.
Lauren did, and she became a Bruin. She made her UCLA basketball debut on November 14th, 2012, in a game against nationally ranked Oklahoma.
And I remember the girl for Oklahoma, she was bad. She was tough. And then Lauren's guarding her. I'm like, oh, okay, here we go. Here we, you know, we're going to learn by fire. It's great. And so she shut this girl down. You know, just every time she got the ball, Lauren was there. Or before she had the ball, she was denying it. She was just all over her. And we ended up winning that game.
I'm like, dang, I can't show anything less of this. And I think that, for me, started to mess me up.
Lauren says she put a lot of pressure on herself to play as hard as she possibly could and to keep meeting that high bar she set in her first college game. And that intensity had some serious consequences.
I was always nervous watching her play because she plays so hard, but I mean, her play, she just goes out there and plays hard no matter what.
This is what I can remember about that season was the concussions.
So my first one in college was actually in summer school. So my freshman summer school, we were playing pickup and I go for a loose ball on the floor and then another guy is coming, going for the same ball and he knees me in the back of my neck. I'm like laying there for a minute, head is hurting, everything is just like hurting. And then out of nowhere, I hear the sirens from an ambulance and they like came and picked me up, put me on a stretcher. I was so embarrassed. I was probably crying because I'm a crier. They put me in the stretcher. They take me right to the UCLA Medical Hospital. And then I had to get a neck brace. And I'm just like, why is this happening? Like, I could have just walked off. We would have been fine. We could have just went to the trainers.
Lauren recovered in time for that breakout game against Oklahoma. But she played in just two more games that year. A string of concussions kept her on the sidelines. She redshirted and came back the next season, but in December 2013...
We were playing SC, and I got screened, and I kind of got tripped on the screen, and I fell back and hit my head.
Next thing I knew it, she just went down. And then she was down for a long time. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what is going on? Like, why isn't she getting up? And so we waited, and then finally they kind of, Shauna and I were in the crowd, and they asked me to come over and say, come over and say, honey, are you okay? And she was like, oh, I think, I don't know.
Lauren left the court with her parents and went through concussion protocol with the UCLA training staff.
I knew at that time. I went back and I said to my husband, we're off the roller coaster. We're not doing it anymore. He's like, I agree.
You knew at that point that
yeah.
That was the end
wasn't
of her
doing
career.
It again. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I felt terrible. I remember it was terrible, like the worst thing ever. Because I went through so much prior to actually retiring, just like working out when I was not feeling good because I was trying to prove to people that like, I don't even know, I just like that I could do it. And so when the time came, I felt like I lost my identity. I felt like, now I'm going to be the loser in my family.
You felt like you were going to be the loser in your family?
Yeah, I just felt like when it came to talking about basketball, I wasn't going to be talked about anymore. And I don't know, I kind of felt like I was in a way going to hold my family back from the potential that we have as a family in like the basketball world. I don't know, I was so down on myself. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do.
She became dark. I'm like, okay, what is going on? I could remember one day I said to my husband, I said, you know what? This is what we're going to do. I think we're going to have to just have Lauren drop out of school. Let her see a therapist. maybe have her go up to the church and work at Sunday school class, things like that, because this is bad. Like, there were some dark times. I remember saying, like, fasting and just praying and crying out, like, Lord, you're going to have to help us here with this one. Because this is hard and this is so unusual for us because her personality was completely changed. Completely changed.
I'm not going to, like, sugarcoat anything because that's just not who I am. It was hard, and I expressed that to whoever asked. I felt like everything was just forced upon me. Like, it was things were happening to me that I didn't want to happen.
While all of this was going on, Aaron was getting recruited to play college basketball. And one of the colleges on his short list was UCLA.
I think she was really excited that UCLA was on Aaron's list of coming to school. And so she took it upon herself to make sure she can sort of sway him towards being a Bruin. You know, I praise God that Lauren had something to work on.
And what did Aaron make of his sister's recruiting effort?
Well, I guess he thought it was awesome because that's where he went. I think he was like, okay, I guess that's where I'm going.
What do you think him being there meant for her and did for her in her recovery and finding kind of a new part of her identity?
I think it was the best thing ever.
I was so happy.
Lauren helped Aaron acclimate to life as a college athlete. And when Lauren was having a hard time, Aaron was there for her too.
Every time I was sad, I would just call Aaron and I'd be like, where are you? And most of the time he'd be in his room chilling. So I'd be like, can you just come up to my room? And I would cry and give him a hug and then we would hang out. Or we would walk to class together. We would go to the gym at like late at night after tutoring and stuff. We would go home together or go to church. When he got there, it was like home came to me.
Lauren Holiday graduated from UCLA in 2016 with a degree in history. She still lives in LA, where she now teaches first grade. And she got to visit Aaron in Indiana for a couple of his NBA games this year. She says they still talk a few times a week.
Aaron is like the person that I dream to be like when I'm older. And I will protect him, all of my brothers, but I will protect him to the day I die.
Lauren can't play organized basketball anymore. She and her brothers have taken to playing tennis and golf. But every so often, when she and Aaron are together, they'll still hoop.
We go to the 24-hour fitness and people are looking at me like, really? She's about to play. And then we get on and we just sweep everybody. When we're on the same team, we're definitely unstoppable.
That story came from Only a Game's Matthew Stock. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef. Traceability so bold that customers can even know the genetic pedigree of their steak or burger. From a six-generation family ranch in the Nebraska Sandhills, Honest Beef is dedicated to telling the story of your beef. Follow along on Instagram to see their life on the ranch, working to provide their customers with high-quality, dry-aged beef that they can feel great about. From their ranch to your door, they'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
It's 1965. A white minister is murdered in Selma, Alabama, but no one is held to account.
More than 50 years later, we return to the place where it happened to call a lie, and finally solve this murder.
White Lies from NPR. New episodes drop Tuesdays.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
VAR are checking for a possible offense by the goalkeeper.
That's from the end of Thursday's Women's World Cup match between Scotland and Argentina, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed via Skype and by The Washington Post's Jerry Brewer. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Shireen, take it away.
So one of the things for everybody following the Women's World Cup that, you know, despite the gong show that we know FIFA is, we expected some level of normalcy and consistency, but we didn't get that. We got video-assisted referee technology. And what that's basically done is destroy the hopes and dreams of many. It's actually completely messed up the technical structure and rollout of how goalkeepers actually move. So I want to just throw this out there that we know that the football goddesses are blessing us with incredible plays and lots of fun, but they're also completely frustrating us to no end with this idea that goalkeepers cannot come off their line when goalkeepers, in fact, are trained to move as soon as someone takes a shot. This rule was implemented 6 days before the Women's World Cup started. And many of the teams didn't actually have time to train their goalkeepers. Lee Alexander's face and even Karen Bardsley, England's goalkeeper, coming out and criticizing the whole thing is just reflective of really how we feel about these types of rules that are, in fact, just using the Women's World Cup as a guinea pig for the men's game.
Anytime you have that level of technological influence, it ruins the game. It should be a judgment call. Too often, I think we want to get everything perfect instead of just putting the onus on the officials, the referees, the challenge it is for a goalkeeper to stop a goal in that situation is just so incredible. And now you're just adding an extra layer of complication to it. That's disappointing to me. And I think there's a lot of issues that come with opening that Pandora's box and allowing technology to interfere with the game.
This is what I don't understand. VAR was introduced in last summer's World Cup in Russia, and it went sort of okay. But the technology and this goalkeeping rule, they're not being applied the same way in the Women's World Cup. And I really can't figure out why the change. Shireen, I know FIFA isn't exactly known for making good decisions, but is there any indication of what's behind this one?
I read a piece by a colleague named Jess Kasouf at The Equalizer, and he rightly pointed out that this is, in fact, something that's used to test. I was in Paris. I saw a couple matches. Many times I saw the goalkeepers getting called on this. It is antithetical to the way that goalkeepers are trained. Like, it's, I'm the mother of a goalkeeper, and I can't imagine adding this type of stress. It's going to prolong shootouts. It's going to ruin the effect of the game, not to mention totally killing my live tweeting of the matches.
And that's important.
Critical.
Jerry, what do you have for us?
Well, LeBron James has a new superstar teammate. His name is Anthony Davis, also known as the Unibrow. But more than that, Anthony Davis is probably the most complete big man in the NBA. And so now the Los Angeles Lakers, they haven't made the postseason for 6 straight years, which is a team record. Now they are making a real power push to challenge the Toronto Raptors. The Golden State Warriors out west are injured, and Kawhi Leonard is not guaranteed to come back to Toronto. So a lot of people are thinking, is this the time that the Lakers take over the league once again?
Shireen, what do you think?
I didn't understand, Jerry. I thought he said Kawhi wasn't coming back to Toronto, so I'm just going to block that out.
I said might not. He's not guaranteed.
Might not. But I think the Raptors winning has really shaken up a little bit of what we think teams and glorious pairings and trios look like. So I'm here for it. Absolutely. I'm here for all of the shakeups and seeing where everybody ends up. It'll be interesting to actually see the rollout, because sometimes teams have chemistry that we don't necessarily think will be successful. And then look what happens.
I mean, am I the only one who's sort of thinking of off-the-court issues when it comes to the Lakers organization, though? We heard reports of employees having panic attacks because they were treated so badly, and you'd hope they'd have figured out all their front office issues by now, but then there are reports now suggesting that the Lakers didn't really understand the salary cap ramifications of the Anthony Davis trade. And I'm thinking, this is really not good. I'd kind of be running away from LA right now. Does all of that behind the scenes front office stuff really have an effect on how LeBron and Anthony Davis are going to perform on the court?
It absolutely has an effect. And I would argue that the two teams that we saw in the finals are the best run teams in the NBA, the best front offices. And the Lakers, Magic Johnson quit because he thought that Rob Pelinka, the general manager, was trying to take his job. Now they are trying to solve their dysfunction with talent. And it's great if they can get LeBron James, Anthony Davis, and even another star. but that's not going to fill out their roster.
Yeah.
And let's just say, Shireen, that Kawhi Leonard does return to Toronto like he should. They are one of the deepest teams in the NBA. I don't see a scenario, if Toronto stays intact, that the Lakers in their state will have enough to beat them. Toronto is such a dynamic, balanced, cohesive machine. I think it would be great for the NBA if they become the standard and not just another superstar collection trying to come together and put together a team.
All right. So on Thursday, news broke that the Tampa Bay Rays are exploring the possibility of splitting time with Montreal. To clarify, the Rays would play home games in both cities, which are 1,500 miles apart. Exactly how this would work is a bit of a mystery. Both cities are in need of a decent baseball venue, and the Rays are locked into St. Petersburg until 2027. On the other hand, this could be a spectacular idea. Montreal would finally get Major League Baseball back after losing the Expos in 2004. And maybe with fewer home games on the schedule, Tampa could actually fill some seats. A friend joked that they'd need to change their name to the X-Rays. Shireen, what do you think of this?
Well, I think of all my Montreal Expo friends that have prayed for the return of baseball, but not like this. Like, this is slightly bizarre to me. I get that the world is small and I'm sure there's resources to be able to do this, but it almost seems to, like, for me, kill the culture of baseball in that specific town. So much of baseball is very tied in locally as well. And I just, I'm not seeing the connection here. And also, I'm wondering what the players might think about this. Like, I have a lot of logistical questions. A lot.
Jerry, how about you?
Yeah, if you're a franchise that's in two places, you have no home. Mm. To me, Major League Baseball, one of the joys is that it's just how local it is. It feels like you're taking a family vacation across the country as you watch a baseball season. To not have 81 games in one ballpark just seems like the wrong way to go. And this is where I must apologize to Montreal, since the Expos are now the Washington Nationals, and we greatly enjoy getting to watch them. But baseball has to decide, you know, how badly do you want to be in Montreal and under what conditions? And then they also must say, can baseball in the Tampa-St. Petersburg area thrive? We have seen over the last 10 years some really good Rays baseball teams, but fans are still not coming. A decision has to be made. You can't be in halfway in two different cities.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed, who co-hosts the Burn It All Down podcast, and the Washington Post's Jerry Brewer. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Had a great time.
Memory is a funny thing. It can change over the years, sometimes by a couple hundred feet.
You know, those home runs that I hit went 550 feet instead of barely making it over the fence, but who cares?
That's Art Shamsky talking about the 14 home runs he hit in 1969 as a utility player for the New York Mets. But memory can do more than exaggerate. It can fade and even disappear altogether. Only a game's Gary Wallach has the story.
As any Mets fan from the age of 2 to 102 will repeatedly tell you, the 1969 baseball season was full of a rare kind of magic. The Mets were horrible during their first six seasons, and only somewhat better than that in 1968. But on the very first day of 1969 spring training, Mets manager Gil Hodges had a message for his team. Again, Art Shamsky.
He basically said, you know, you guys are better than you think. You lost a lot of one-run games. If you can find some way to win those close games, anything can happen. And basically, he was right.
After a lousy start, the Mets went on an 11-game late spring winning streak behind the lockdown pitching of Jerry Kuzman and 24-year-old ace Tom Seaver.
And any time he pitched, you know that he was capable of pitching a complete game and winning.
When the 1969 regular season ended, the Mets were 162. Tom Seaver finished with 25 wins and just 7 losses. He'd later win the National League Cy Young Award. He was widely celebrated in New York as Tom Terrific, but his teammates also knew him as the humble heart and soul of the team. The Mets made the World Series, but many predicted New York's Cinderella season would end there against the powerful Baltimore Orioles. Seaver took the mound for Game 1, and the Mets lost, but they bounced back to sweep the next 4 games.
There's a fly ball hit out to left, waiting is Jones. The Mets are the world champions.
The Mets were heroes in New York.
I've talked to a lot of people over the years, and probably 150,000 have told me they were at the last game on October 16th, 1969, when we won the World Series. And I think Shea Stadium at the time probably held 53,000 at most. And either they were there in spirit or they were there in person. It doesn't make any difference because I just think, you know, they were there.
In the years and decades that followed, members of the amazing Mets remained in the public eye. They'd attend events where the former teammates would relive their glory days. But Shamsky knew that those opportunities wouldn't last forever. He had heard that Tom Seaver was suffering from Lyme disease, which was affecting his memory. He called shortstop Bud Harrelson, Tom's friend and roommate on the road. Harrelson lived on Long Island and was in the early stages of Alzheimer's.
We thought it would be a good idea for him to go out there and see Tom.
So in late 2016, Shamsky decided to organize a visit to see Tom Seaver, who lived with his wife Nancy at their Calistoga, California vineyard estate. Shamsky also recruited former Mets outfielder Ron Swoboda, who lived in New Orleans, and pitcher Jerry Kuzman, who lived in the Midwest.
The two of them were just characters. I knew that if I got them together, I could stir some memories and stir some interesting conversation.
Shamsky called Nancy Seaver and asked if they could visit Tom for a couple days.
And she said, you know, you might come out here and he might not feel too good and it might be a wasted trip.
Shamsky and the gang decided to risk it anyway. In May of 2017, the group arrived at the airport in San Francisco. They hopped in a rented van and headed north to Napa Valley. That evening, as they neared the Seaver home in Calistoga, Shamsky called Nancy to tell her they were almost there. She said,
"It's late today. I don't think it's a good idea."
Shamsky and his teammates stayed that night at a nearby hotel. They had no idea if they'd be able to see Tom Seaver before they had to drive back to San Francisco and fly home.
And the next day, I called her and she said, "You guys are in luck. He's feeling pretty good today. Get over here as soon as you can." Physically, he looked great, and it was just awesome for all of us to sit around and talk. And we spent 8 or 9 hours just reminiscing and talking about the team and talk about things that were important to us.
Seaver took Shamsky, Harrelson, Swoboda, and Kuzman on a tour of the vineyard. For 2 decades, Seaver and his wife Nancy had lived on their 116-acre estate. They now produce about 500 cases of Cabernet Sauvignon per year. Seaver told the guys that he tended his vines every single day.
And he showed us what he does to help prepare the grapes for the wine, and he loved being out in the vineyards, and he loved that part of his life.
Seaver pruned grapevines as they walked, and he told them all about irrigation, cultivation, and the business of winemaking. Seaver seemed just fine to his old teammates. On the last day of their visit, Seaver suggested lunch at a downtown Calistoga restaurant. His Lyme disease kept him from traveling much.
And so I figured he was going to hop a ride with us in the van that we rented. He said, "No, I'll drive." And he looks at me and Swoboda, and I don't think both of us were real crazy about that idea.
The Seaver Vineyard is on the side of a mountain. The road to town is windy and treacherous. Shamsky and company wondered if Seaver would forget the directions, or worse. But Seaver prevailed, and after a long, slow crawl down the mountain, they arrived at the restaurant.
He's like the king there. He walked in, got a couple bottles of wine, and it was really good wine.
For the record, it wasn't Seaver's, which retails for $150 to $350 a bottle, depending on the vintage.
Yeah, we wanted to taste his wine, but I guess a cheapskate didn't want to give us any of his wine.
They talked for several more hours. Shamsky says Seaver remembered a lot about the Mets' 1969 season.
Oh, he did. He did. He remembered about the playoffs, and it was just wonderful. You have these relationships and you have these feelings for guys. They're your brothers. You won with them and you lost with them. But you shared this golden moment.
They talked for several more hours, poring over details as only ex-teammates can. And then Seaver asked a question. Are you guys here to see the vineyard? After lunch, it was time to leave.
We kind of said goodbye out in the parking lot of the restaurant, and all of us felt a little twinged because you get to a certain age, and it wasn't just about Tom saying goodbye, it was about all of us. And so when we said goodbye, it was bittersweet.
Shamsky returned home to Manhattan and began work on a book about the 1969 Mets and the trip to visit Seaver. And then on March 7th of this year, there was bad news. Seaver had been diagnosed with dementia. His family announced that Seaver had made his last public appearance. He'll spend the time he has left with family at his Napa Valley estate.
That's like a kick in the gut.
The Mets will honor members of the 1969 team during a three-game series against Atlanta next weekend. Shamsky says he'll be there with many of his former Mets teammates. He's looking forward to it, but he can't help thinking about Tom Seaver.
I don't know if he'll make it. I really don't.
He does know, but can you blame Art Shamsky if he can't bring himself to rule out the possibility of just one more golden moment, one more conversation full of happy memories with his friend Tom Seaver?
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Art Shamsky's new book is After the Miracle, The Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets. It's co-authored by Eric Sherman, who was also on the trip to see Tom Seaver. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. So you're listening to this NPR podcast because you want to be informed. You want to learn something. You want to be a better citizen. Great, we're all for that. I should listen to more podcasts myself. But what if you need a little break? What if that little voice in the back of your head stops saying, do this, it's good for you, and starts whispering fart jokes and rude noises? Well, then you want to check out Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. It's the show that lets your lizard brain enjoy itself for once. You can be serious again later. New episodes drop Saturdays. Listen and tell your friends.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, how Andre Iguodala lost his starting role and became an NBA Finals MVP. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
In a move that surprised no one, the New Orleans Pelicans took Zion Williamson with the first pick in the NBA draft. Good choice?
Oh, well, yeah, I think so. He's been the consensus top pick in the 2019 NBA draft since about 2015, I think. They did the right thing by doing the only thing.
It's really nice that Pelicans executive David Griffin is reminding reporters that Zion is young and won't immediately lead the team, even saying, quote, don't write this like he's here to save the franchise, but he is there to save the franchise, right?
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, I mean, he's already a marketing genius. I don't know if you've been to New Orleans. They sell these saint candles, and now there is a Zion Williamson voodoo saint candle you can buy, yes. Which would be the only Zion Williamson tchotchke that I would buy.
So it was strange enough when the NBA launched an esports league, but now they're taking it to another level with a virtual sports league created explicitly to keep the gamblers entertained. The league will use actual game footage to create a fictitious game that plays out over 90 seconds with the outcome determined by a random number generator. What could go wrong?
Well, one thing that could go wrong is I guarantee you there's already a windowless room in Kiev with a bunch of guys who already know how to hack this thing. I honest to God don't understand this.
I don't either.
I mean, I go to the track, I bet on the horse. If my horse crosses the finish line first or reasonably close to it,
yeah,
I win.
Woo-hoo.
That's all I need.
My favorite quote from the NBA's head of fantasy and gaming goes like this, quote, "We've been looking at this the past couple of years and we're really surprised to see how popular this was."
I would like to be the NBA's head of fantasy and gaming for a while. I
think sounds
that
like
could
a
be
good
fun.
Job.
I could like make myself the starting center for the Bulls because that would be the center of my fantasy.
Okay, are you ready for some football? I mean, some songs about football?
No, but I spent all last football season listening to this song and was never ready for it. But lay it on me.
All right. A songwriting team is suing Carrie Underwood for stealing the song that opened Sunday Night Football last season. And I'm going to let you be the judge on this one. Here's the original as sung by Heidi Merrill. And here is Carrie Underwood's version. All right, what say you, Judge Pierce?
Guilty! Yeah, that sounds like a cop to me. Why anybody would want to take credit for that mess is beyond me, but that's not a decision for this court to make. I'd say it's pretty much the same song. You know how I know? Because each one of them irritates me in exactly the same way.
All right. Well, Lenny Dykstra is a bit of a tragic figure, known as much these days for his very long rap sheet as he is for his MLB career. But on Father's Day morning, Dykstra got a big win. What was it?
They found his $80,000 dentures, which he had apparently left in the bread of a sandwich, near as I can tell. It went to a submarine sandwich shop, and, you know, apparently they came out, and he put them in a napkin and then forgot the napkin, and they went in the dumpster. And this is my favorite part. He and his running buddy, Sprinkles the Clown, went dumpster diving and actually wound up with his teeth.
How did he eat the sandwich without his teeth?
Oh, that's a very good question. I don't know. Molars, I guess. Really good molars.
Really good ones. And finally, Charlie, I'd like to introduce you to 103-year-old Julia Hurricane Hawkins. She started running at age 100, and this week she set a record at the National Senior Games in Albuquerque. What was it?
She ran the 100 meters in 39.62 seconds, which I'm not entirely sure I could do. She's believed to be the oldest woman ever to compete in a meet. A legitimate meet on an American track. I don't know if they have age groups, but I can't believe she's got a lot of competition. She said she has to race every race because she's not really sure how many 100 meters she's got left.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Zion Williamson was projected to be the top NBA draft pick even before he got to college. Our last story this week is about an incoming college freshman who isn't likely to be a number one pick, but he's already believed to have made basketball history. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Sonia Bennett knew something was different about her son Kalen at an early age.
I'm talking like 3 months, 3 to 6 months. He wasn't focusing on me. He wasn't trying to make any noises or anything like that.
Sonia had already had a daughter. She says doctors told her,
well, you know, boys do things a little bit slower than girls, but my heart kept telling me that something was wrong.
When Kalen was about 9 months to a year old, he was diagnosed with autism.
And as time progressed, you know, they were saying that he wasn't going to talk. Wasn't going to walk, and that I should look at these different, you know, facilities for him. And I said no. I had a child with an ability to do great things, but they just wanted to put a period on it and just tell me to just throw my hands up. Well, I did throw my hands up, but I just said, God help me to help Kalen.
Sonia and her former husband lived in Arkansas. Eventually, Sonia found a doctor outside of Little Rock named Mitzi Washington.
What was that first conversation like with her?
Morning was a lot of tears. I said, something's wrong with me. Is something wrong with me? I mean, you're hysterical. because you're fighting, it seemed like you're fighting against a brick wall of people. And she told me that, no, there's nothing wrong with you. And she gave me a big hug and told me that it was going to be okay.
Sonia says Dr. Washington set Kaylin up with a therapist who came to the house 3 times a week. When the therapist wasn't there, Sonia says she'd try to work with Kaylin on her own.
And nothing happened right away. Nothing happened right away. It's not no pop your finger and here it is, you know, type of deal.
But Kaylin started making progress.
When he began to sit up, he would beat on the pots and stuff. Like if I would open up the refrigerator, I noticed that he was beating on the pots. And then if I closed the refrigerator, he would beat on them a lot stronger. So I'm like, are you trying to talk to me, little boy?
Kaylin would beat on the pots when he wanted something out of the refrigerator. If Sonia grabbed the wrong thing, Kaylin would beat harder.
And so I say that was first voice without voice.
Sonia says that at age 3, Kaylin started to walk. At age 7, he started to talk.
I don't remember a thing before I was talking, honestly.
That's Kaylin.
Well, Kaylin, once you started speaking, what do you remember about where you grew up and what your childhood was like?
I just remember always being kind of private, like always to myself. I didn't want to be around nobody.
He was just alone, you know, playing with his toys or whatever and watching Blue's Clues. That was it.
Then something happened at school. Kaylin thinks it was about 3rd grade. There was a pep rally for the basketball team.
And for some reason, I wanted to go up there with them. And they're like, hey, Kaylin, sit down. You're not on the basketball team. So, like, I went home that same exact day, and I said, Dad, I want to play basketball.
Sonia remembers her reaction when she found out about Kaylin's request.
Scared to death. His sensory process was very, 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 very bad. He didn't know danger. I mean, it was a lot of things for me to be afraid of as a mother, you know? But I also knew that the social skills, I wanted him to have developed social skills.
Kaylin's father told Sonia that basketball would be good for him, and she talked to Dr. Washington.
She was like, let's just see how he reacts to it.
Kaylin joined an AAU team, the Arkansas Hawks. Kaylin was very tall, but it wasn't an easy transition. Some of his teammates had grown up playing basketball. He was new to the sport. Learning plays and coaching schemes was difficult. But Kaylin and his coach came up with a way of communicating that worked.
Okay, so I love math. I can do math problems like that in my head.
He's a mathematician. So Coach Howard figured that out. And so he would use numbers to show him the different plays in the beginning.
Hoops fans are probably familiar with this system, but Coach Howard used basketball's traditional numbers as a stand-in for all the different positions. So a 1 represented the point guard, 2 for the shooting guard, 3 for the small forward, and so on.
So basically, he'll write those numbers down and tell me what number goes where in a play. Or if something happens to this number is supposed to do this. It kind of cleared, like, a lot of, like, confusion.
Still, Kaylin wasn't having a lot of success on the court. But when he was in the 5th grade, his team played a game in Detroit.
They were babies. They was losing. They put Kaylin in the game. And when they put him in the game, he started making shots. And that was his first time ever making a shot.
I just remember I shot a free throw. Everybody go crazy. I made the next one. Even the opposing team fans go crazy.
And he kept going, making the shots. And we were cheering. The people were looking at us like we were crazy, but we were cheering just like they were winning by 50 and they were losing by 30. But you would think that the heavens opened up. And that's when I said, oh, he's going to be good. He's going to be all right. You know, it took a while for him to catch on to, like, this is what I'm supposed to do. And when he did it, he never stopped.
And after he started playing basketball, Kaylin says life got better for him off the court.
I started to break some of the walls I was struggling with. You know, just being able to talk to people, hang out with the other kids, be tougher. And then going into middle school, I learned a lot about just letting myself be myself, like not being anybody else, just be Kaylin. And then I transferred to high school.
In 2018, Sonia Bennett, who had been told her son might never walk or never talk, watched Kaylin graduate high school from Little Rock Christian Academy.
The fun part about it was I got my diploma. Just about almost everybody in the whole place stood up.
But that wasn't the end of Kaylin's journey.
When did you realize that you could actually play college basketball? When did that cross your mind for the first time?
I say, actually, be honest with you, I never doubted it. I never doubted. That's not even cockiness. That's just being brutally honest. I know I can play.
During high school, Kaylin, who'd grown to be 6'10", committed to play at the Division I University of Arkansas at Little Rock. But Kaylin ultimately decided to do a post-grad year at Link Year, a Christian gap year program with academics and sports in Branson, Missouri. Before he started there, Kaylin had one more summer playing AAU basketball.
I started getting offers off the rip. And then at the end of the season, after we came from Vegas, I got a call saying, Kaylin, we would like to offer you a full scholarship to play at Kent State. I was overjoyed. I don't know what it was, but I was just overjoyed.
Division I Kent State plays in the mid-major Mid-American Conference. Kaylin and Sonia visited the campus about 40 miles from Cleveland.
And we decided we're going to Kent State.
Kaylin Bennett is believed to be the first person with autism to sign a national letter of intent to play a Division I team sport. The news got a big reaction.
He was once told he would never walk or talk.
Kaylin Bennett, 6'10" basketball player from Little Rock, Arkansas, has committed to play at Kent State University next year.
Well wishes now flood his Instagram. You give a mom like me hope.
What's it felt like to get all of this response?
I mean, like, I knew I was going to inspire a couple of people. I didn't think I was going to inspire thousands of people across the country, not even the country, like around the world. I was just speaking my testimony.
Kaylin, who, for the record, says he's now 6'11", is already in Ohio, getting ready for his freshman year at Kent State. And he's not alone. Sonia's moved there, too.
If I need something, she's going to be right there. I can go over there anytime. I can invite my teammates if I want. Yes, ma'am. I'm bringing them. she gave me the goofy eye.
Sonia knows her son's come a long way since those days playing with toys and watching Blue's Clues by himself.
If they telling you what you can't do, believe in your child and fight for your child. They can do what any other child can do if you give them the opportunity to do it.
Our story on Kaylin and Sonia Bennett came from Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Well, Kaylin, anything else that you want to add before I let you go?
I got to give a shout out. Shout out Linky. Shout out Little Rock Christian. Shout out the Arkansas Hawks. Shout out to all the mamas out there. And
thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
I got to give a shout out to Nico Emack, Martin Kessler, Matthew Stock, and Gary Wallach for producing our show each week. Shout out to our technical director, Marquise Neal, for making it all sound great. Shout out to our new intern, Arlo Moore Bloom. And shout out to our executive producer. Oh, wait, that's me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.